Everybody, are we getting on? I'm Ian, and this is Kelly, and we've got a special guest with us. We're number 19. We're getting there, Kelly. Who was it who said on number two or three that if we get to 20, we're in the big league? We're in with all the podcasting big dogs. What a wonderful. And then we're going to retire. Or we can keep going, probably keep going, I hope. How's everybody getting on? Hope you're all well. Welcome to episode 19 of the Alcohol Uncensored podcasts. Like I say, I'm Ian, and in 14 days, 2 weeks, that is, I will be 6 years alcohol free, very similar to our guest today. Yeah, it's going good, as we always say. I could bang on about it all the time, but I'm not going to. I'm going to keep it brief because I want to have a quick chat with Kelly and then introduce our fabulous guest. What I want to ask Kelly is, firstly, hello, and secondly, how are you feeling after last week's podcast? What sort of, have you had any feedback, either from, you know, sort of people in the AU community or wider community or family or friends? Or, because I've had some feedback and it's been pretty impressive, but have you had any?
Yeah, I've had some feedback. It's been a bit, to be honest with you, I feel exhausted today. And I was just thinking, I actually did that before we come on here. And I think it's because I've been kind of putting clips out of myself. Obviously, I do the social media for the community. So I've been putting clips out of myself. And it's like sharing my deepest and darkest secrets, or some of them at least. And it's a little bit like I'd messaged my mum one day and said, do you think this is okay to put out? Because I'm conscious I don't want to kind of affect them either. My mum was like, if you just do what you feel, Kelly, do what feels right. So I think I've been a little bit exhausted this week because I think it's took a lot out of me I did share a lot, and I kind of was thinking, oh God, have I shared too much? But it's the truth. All I kept coming back to was it's the truth, and if it helps one person, then it's worth it. So yeah, I'm looking forward to just a chilled weekend. It's been one of those weeks where it's been busy head time.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? And it might be a weird one. Do you listen back to your podcasts?
No, I don't listen back to it at all. So thankfully, when I do the clips, I can just pull the text. I don't listen to any of the podcasting. I just use the transcript and pick out the good bits using the words to put it out there. I can't listen to myself. Right.
I wish you hadn't said that, because I listen to myself a lot. Well, not a lot, but I listen back to my, you know, I listen to all the podcasts.
Yeah. I'm glad you do.
But I listen to my own, because do you know what? I think when you listen back, I hear things that I'm saying that I wouldn't otherwise be able to compute, if you know what I mean. I wouldn't pick these things up. But I hear things, I think, crikey, Ian, that's quite noticeable that you say that. And I wonder, and it helps me to sort of analyse why I have certain thoughts and why I go on the way I do. So, maybe I'm a bit weird.
Yeah. No, actually, I was talking to someone about this last week, and I thought, I probably should listen to it and then kind of see about, like, understand different things I say, and also see how much I've kind of grown in confidence as well, because we don't give ourselves kudos quite a lot of the time for how much we've kind of progressed. So I should probably listen to it sometimes, and I may, when I go on holiday, I listen to some episodes. I couldn't listen to my own episode, but yeah, I'm glad you do, because then obviously you can tell us if it's shite or not. Excuse me.
It's too late, isn't it? If I'm listening to it, well, although we have the draft version, don't we? Which I listen to. But so I tend to listen to them twice. I listen to them on the draft version, and I listen to them when they're out. So
you're going to skew our listener numbers.
Well, I was going to say that's why the listening figures. So good, right? Okay, yeah, I can have one listen. That's it. One credit. Right, let's not waste any more time waffling. Let's introduce our fabulous guest, who you and I have known for quite a while, within the, again, we say this all the time, don't we, within the over the influence community originally. And it's lovely to have her on as a guest. She's been beaten to the punch by her husband, who we had on 2 or 3 weeks ago. But this lady definitely knows her AF onions, and it's lovely to welcome Annie Knowles. Hello, Annie. How are you getting on?
I'm really well, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on this podcast. And yeah, I've missed you both actually. I've just watched you from the sidelines, and everything that you're creating together with the podcast here. It's just wonderful seeing just how far you've both come and how you keep going, encouraging people. It's been wonderful.
Well, thank you. We're loving it, aren't we?
And I just want to say, Anna, before we go any further, kind of talk about you a little bit. The book that you and your husband kind of co-wrote was amazing. Like when I could hear, I listened to it. So hearing your voice and your honesty about how you felt about AA and his recovery in the beginning, it was really humbling to listen to it. I really enjoyed it. I thought the two of you have done a fantastic job of that book. I listened to it and I've also got the copy as well because there's so many good stuff in it. I loved it that there was the two sides of the coin. Your husband's alcoholism, and then your choice to go alcohol free for, well, we can talk about this in the chat, but I just loved the kind of two sides of the alcohol scale that we spoke about. So a massive well done on that, and thank you.
No, thanks. It's really great hearing that because, believe it or not, I don't think he would have mentioned this, but it was an accident that I even ended up in the book,
Okay.
because his what do you call them, the publishers, they asked me to give an account of they didn't they weren't explicit in what they wanted me to do, actually. They just said, could I write a summary from the wife's point of view about alcohol? And I took that as meaning my own journey, and I wrote them a piece of me discovering my own relationship with alcohol and how, that kind of intertwined with Charlie's story. And I submitted that, and then they came back and said, "Oh my goodness, are you alcohol free?" And I said, "Yes." And he'd obviously not really mentioned that bit to them, because the bit of the gray area drinking only came in when they realized we need to put this in, because originally it was just going to be the science and Charles's, I call him Charlie's story. But actually the book started to change once they realized that, oh my goodness, the two of you are alcohol free. Now, can you write some more pieces? And that's how it all came about. So it's great to get that feedback actually, because it's got his name on the book. We're both on the audio, but actually, it's his name on the book. But yes, we both wrote it and we're both part of it. So it's great to hear that. Thank you.
It worked amazingly. It really did.
And it's proven a popular read, isn't it? I think you're saying it's in Waterstones. It's in all reputable bookshops. But if you're in Waterstones, you've made it, haven't you? It's
It is.
well.
It's on all bookshelves. But the feedback that I'm getting from a lot of people that are in the kind of sobriety communities is, those that have taken the time to be able to sit and read it and go through it have really enjoyed it. But I do appreciate that it is science, and science isn't everybody's cup of tea. And I think it's one of those books that might be a bit difficult to read if maybe you're approaching, trying to become alcohol free, because there's just too much information. It's one of those books that I think you need to sit down and take in small pieces and take what you need. And there's various chapters there that you can dig into for whatever stage of your alcohol free journey you're at. So,
Good stuff. Anyway, he's had his time, Annie. It's your time now. So we'll talk about you from now on. But I know it's great, great book, and it was like Kelly, I listened to it, and it's really nice to read, and it covers the full spectrum, doesn't it? It's great. So yeah. What we tend to do is we tend to sort of fairly predictably, like a lot of sort of podcasts of this ilk, we tend to sort of start at the beginning, if you like, in terms of, where did your sort of alcohol-free life start, and where did it take you to, and then, where did you end up when you sort of actually got to the point where I've had enough of this and I want to change things. So do you mind just going back to the start and telling us a bit about your history, if you like, and we can build it up from there?
So I grew up in Wigan in Lancashire, in the northwest of England. And I had a very happy childhood. I'm one of seven children. But I am the only adopted mixed race child in a family of seven, and so that as a child didn't really give me any kind of outwardly, difficult moments, if you like, but I do think it shaped the adult that I've become. And I've realized this now in my kind of alcohol-free journey. But, you know, my early days were really happy. I literally had a ready-made set of friends, you know, living at home, and the most wonderful brothers and sisters. And I was the eldest girl of seven children. I had a brother older than me, but the others all came along after I was adopted. So I was always there in the family. And so I've always been known to all of my brothers and sisters as their big sister, if you like. And so, yeah, happy childhood, great, you know, memories of growing up. My parents were really loving, both worked really hard. And when you've got seven kids, you've got to, you know, work hard. And, you know, we kind of just kept ourselves busy, I suppose. I did actually sort of grow up being a young mum, a second mum, if you like, helping to look after the younger ones. That was kind of memories of mine. But I think I kind of grew up age appropriate, though, when I really think about it, because, you know, in my teenage years, I was fairly quiet as a child. I was quite studious, a bit boring, to be honest with you, if you like. I didn't really like to be sort of seen. And so I was sort of the child that didn't put my hand up in class, I think, because I didn't really want to be pointed out. I liked to be in the background. And I found that, you know, my friends, when they were in their teens, they were going off doing teenage things that you did in the 80s. You know, they were out in the on their bikes in the park, swigging overproof cider and stuff. And I was just either at home hanging with my family or just doing things like going to the roller disco with my friends and, you know, just going around in circles and enjoying myself. It was like, you know,
very normal.
Yeah. And then, you know, moving into my late teens, I realized that everybody went to the pub. That's how people socialized. And, you know, I tagged along, I went, I really, really didn't see the point in alcohol as a teenager. I kind of just followed the crowd and did what they were doing. But I do remember really struggling to get any alcohol down at all. I just hated the taste of it. I just didn't want to touch it. I was, you know, some people do talk about that. I mean, Charlie, when we had him on, you know, in his book, he mentions that the very first taste of alcohol did something for him. You know, it changed his whole mindset about the person he was. It didn't do that for me. I was somebody that literally had to, you know, put as much sweetness into a glass of something to try and hide the taste of alcohol. So, you know, my very first drink that I ever had that I managed to get down was a Malibu and pineapple, you know, just the most disgusting sweet drink. And, you know, this is well before Alcopops have been invented. I was inventing my own, you know, put orange juice in that, put, you know, black currant, whatever you could. It was like just hide the taste of this disgusting thing. And so I really just didn't see the point of alcohol. And I was somebody that could quite easily, even while I was at university, sit with a half a glass of lager shandy on the table for an entire night and just enjoy the conversation with the people. But I needed to be in the pub with everybody. It was almost like that was the social setting if I wanted to be part of all of that. And then I think, you know, throughout my 20s, I kind of just gravitated towards not just social drinking, but wanting to sort of do what other people were doing. So things like shots, you know, if that was part of the evening, I would do it. That was good for me because it meant I didn't have to drink it. I didn't have to taste it. I could get it down as quickly as possible. But I was the sort of person that I was always sick. I was the person that everybody had stories about because I couldn't hold my alcohol. I was the person that needed somebody to always have a scrunchie to put my hair up so they could help me at the toilet. And, you know, so many stories of Annie being sick, you know. And I realized now that was my body's way of stopping myself from being poisoned. You know, I'd obviously overloaded my system with alcohol and it just was rejecting it. But I didn't know that at the time. I thought being sick was the sign of a good night out, you know. So I thought I'm doing all right. And so, yeah, that kind of carried on. And I met Charlie when I was 27 and he was a big drinker. And, you know, I'm the sort of person that likes to fit in and be with the crowd of people that I'm with. And so I do think I started to learn to drink more and better when I met my husband because I wanted to keep up with him. But I do remember, actually, no, it wasn't then, it was later on, but trying to think of, drinking drink for drink with a man when, but I'm short, I'm 5 foot 2, he's nearly 6 foot, and our physiology surely, is different. But I didn't even think about that at the time. So, every time we went to the bar, I would get a drink. I would get a drink. So of course I got drunker quicker. And I just carried on. I just tried to keep up. And he had lots of big drinking friends. So we had a huge drinking community of friends that we hung out with. Everybody seemed to be doing the same, so it didn't seem to be, anything to worry about. And for me, it really kind of all changed once we got married and had our daughter, because all of a sudden, motherhood was very important to me. I changed completely. I really loved being a mum, and I think it maybe had something to do with my adoption as well. Holding the baby for the first time and realizing I've got my first flesh and blood on this earth. This is my DNA inside this child. It was so, I absolutely adored being a mum. I adored my daughter, and I would do anything that I could to be a good mum. And that meant, focusing on her. At the same time, Charlie was kind of continuing the lifestyle that we'd had before we got married. So he was still going out with his friends, drinking, coming home late. And I think loneliness was probably the start of my drinking at home, because I'd never drank at home before my daughter was born. We never ever had really alcohol in the fridge. And all of a sudden, I don't even know how it appeared. There was a bottle of wine in the fridge, and I never used to drink wine. But all of a sudden, wine became a really good friend. But it wasn't problematic drinking at the time. It just became more regular for me. It was literally, most evenings, I would wait for Charlie to come home. I'd always leave, in plenty in the bottle for the two of us to enjoy together. And it really felt like it was the social glue between us, me waiting for him to come home and then just to finish the bottle of wine together. Often he would have started another bottle of wine. But in those days, in the earlier stages, I just remember thinking that the wine was something important in our marriage. And it was very good for me to not feel that I was left alone. I had a friend in the fridge, and it was quite easy. So that became a habit. My friends, who'd had babies around about the same time, I was part of that mummy wine culture. I was on maternity leave. What do? You go out, you meet your friends with the buggies, your babies, you go to the pub. You sit and have a glass of wine at lunchtime, and all of a sudden, this earlier in the day drinking that you associate with people who supposedly have a problem, it was okay for me to do as a mother. And it was seen as completely normal. I'm not saying that we got legless, but we still, we did it because it was something we could do. We weren't working, so you could go and have a glass of wine. And it wasn't every day, it was just occasional again, but that became normal. And really, I suppose from there, the problems that Charlie and I had in our marriage because of, his struggles with alcohol, there was issues. It's in the book. The first time he went to AA, I felt more deserted then than when we were actually living together, when he was drinking. And I look at that. I look back now and think, I know that he needed to do that, but I couldn't see it at the time. For me, he was swapping the pub and his friends in the pub for his new AA buddies, and I struggled with that. And I think I started to drink more, almost in defiance that he was stopping drinking. So I could see there was like these steps in my life where alcohol became a little more regular and needed, if you like. And there was definitely, other things. So I'm not sure again if he mentioned this. I did listen to his podcast, but I can't remember. He probably didn't mention it. It's in the book. Our son was diagnosed with autism age 8, and that was, another drinking period for me, I think, where, you want to just stop the feelings and the thoughts that are going on and the worries that you've got for your child. I mean, those worries, I look back now. Don't know if you've seen anything that I've posted recently on Facebook, but our son is now a musician, and he's living his best life. It's like I had no worries, but I couldn't see that at the time. So that was definitely, another time in my life where the drinking started to ramp up. And like many other busy women who are trying to hold down a family, and who are working full time, the stress of work, especially when you worked in the NHS, was really hard. And so that kind of, demarcation of the day, coming home from a busy day, needing to unwind, you drop your bag, you take your coat off. Almost the very first thing you do is open the fridge because you want a glass of wine. So that became normal. And I never ever saw any of this as abnormal, but it was almost, I can now look back and see it was creeping up. And it was a very, very slow creep. There was a few occasions, like I've just discussed, that definitely made it slightly worse. I was drinking to excess over those periods, but I do think it was a steady incline of me getting to a position where I did feel like I needed to stop.
You mentioned the NHS there, and you remind me, well, what is it that you do within, or what did you do rather within the NHS?
Yeah, so I took early retirement 18 months ago from the NHS. So I worked in radiology. I qualified as a radiographer back in 92, and I then went on to further specialise in ultrasound as a sonographer, doing scanning people, putting a probe on any part of your body and having a look at it and telling you what was wrong with you. And I did that from 2000. So in 2020, sorry, yeah, in 2024, end of 24, I left the NHS. So I'd done 33 years. NHS service, and I'd worked in the same organisation for 26. I was somebody that really was dedicated to my job, and I loved it. But it really was the tipping point for me with my alcohol journey, because that all happened in the pandemic. So I never realised that I had any problem at all with alcohol, yet there was this creeping up of use of alcohol, at home. And well, I've not mentioned when I went out socially, there was quite a few tales about me, end of night and the sort of state I got into. So drinking to excess with friends. But it was during the pandemic that really, that was the mirror that was held up to me in my drinking, because by that point, Charlie had been sober 5 years. And he and my children at the time were not drinking, and you're locked down in a house with people that are not drinking. And yet I was coming home from work during the pandemic, where I'd been working in an old previous role, managing a hospital site radiology department that was a COVID centre. So we were it's a big hospital in East London. And with that came all the challenges of managing staff, the changing policies and procedures that were all happening in that kind of, period where the entire country, the world was on standstill, not knowing what was going on. And in the background, we were having to work within the NHS on a day-to-day basis, with retraining staff, within radiology, prioritizing patients as to say, whether we'd scan them or not. And I was having to make a lot of those calls and call up patients and say, you're not going to get your tests just yet. You're going to have to wait. And taking home that kind of worry of, what if this person ends up developing something as a result of my decisions? Obviously it wasn't just purely my decisions. We took information from our radiologist, but it was taking home that load with you, and the stress of the situation, the staff that were all worried, the problems we had in the initial stages with no PPE. It was just constant, cyclical stress. And so I found myself, literally wearing a cape in work, like some sort of superhero, keeping it together for everybody. But at the end of the day, I would just go home and I would, hit the wine. And then I would get up in the morning and do it all again. And for the first sort of, first part of the pandemic, probably for the first 3 or 4 months, I don't remember having a break. I think it was 7 days on completely. And that takes its toll on you, you know, especially when you're not getting enough rest, you're not getting enough sleep, obviously. And it was just a moment standing in the aisle, in the drinks aisle in Sainsbury's supermarket after work one night. It was the middle of July 2020. And I remember standing there and just thinking, reaching for a bottle of wine and thinking, I don't want this. And I sat there and I just stood there for a second. And I just looked at that bottle of wine and I thought, oh my God, I can't help myself. And I picked the bottle up and I put it in the basket and I paid for it. And I remember even putting it through the till thinking, what am I doing? I don't want this. And that was the moment that I realized that I'd almost lost control, you know, that control that I always thought that I always had over alcohol wasn't there anymore. And it was just that it wasn't a rock bottom moment, it wasn't anything huge. It was this realization that I needed to do something about this. So either, you know, seek help in some way, but I'm the sort of person that didn't want to seek help. I, you know, the issue with the alcohol in our relationship was that Charlie was the one with the problem. I was the one that was okay. I was the one that he almost was the you know, the person who'd been in the sidelines, the victim of all of this in a way, you know. And so I didn't want to talk to him about it. I didn't want to tell him that I was struggling. And he'd never noticed or said anything to me about my drinking. And so, you know, in a way, when nobody's really sort of saying anything to you, it just felt uncomfortable me having that conversation with him. So I kind of did what everybody does. You Google, am I an alcoholic? You check off the list. You go, no, or you try and find no's. You know, you say, oh, no, I don't do
Yeses into noes, yes.
no, not yet, not yet, no, you know. But as I was doing that, I actually suddenly, you know, as algorithms do, Annie Grace from the Live Alcohol Experiment popped up on my feed. And I looked at her and I suddenly thought, oh my goodness, what is this? Somebody that deals with taking a break from alcohol. And so I clicked into the link and I joined her 30-day program. And that was the start of me realizing that actually you could choose to not drink rather than have to not drink. And that was the start of it for me. It was almost like this light bulb moment of, hold on a minute, I'm not the only person as well. There are other people out there that are also wanting to stop drinking, and some that are just wanting to take a break. Little did I know at the time that the taking a break was going to lead me into a completely new lifestyle. But yeah, it was a light bulb moment for me, actually.
So you're just over 6 years
I'm
alcohol
actually
free, right?
not, you know,
No,
so that's
quite
that.
coming up.
No. So it would be 6 years. But don't forget, I joined that group to take a break. So, and I did just that. And guess what? Since I've taken the break, I thought, right, that's it. That's it. I am fine now. I'm fine now. Off I go, drink again. And then I did another. I actually ended up doing four alcohol experiments, and I took a I didn't drink for any one of them, but I drank in between each one of them. But I would say that every single, you know, 30-day break that I took taught me something about myself, taught me something about my physiology, my psychology, the way that I was thinking about alcohol. And I was also learning about alcohol with the education piece in the background, you know, by taking the break and giving myself that kind of, you know, structured community, if you like, you know, whilst I was doing it. So it had all the elements, the community, the education, the ability to, you know, to suddenly lose the shame, you know. Something that I didn't actually mention earlier about their drinking, I think, and I'm going to say this because, you know what, last week you were so open and honest, Kelly, with, you know, I knew you in over the influence community, and I didn't know your story. And to hear you talk about yourself and your struggles with such vulnerability. I was just so impressed and just so honored that you shared all of that. And I thought, you know, that more people need to talk about where they were with their drinking and how they struggle. So, you know, even though I say to people, my drinking wasn't really problematic, it was because, you know, I had tried to do dry Januaries since 2013. So, you know, that those stages of change that they talk about, the pre-contemplation and whatever, that was there back in 2013. You know, and I tried it every single year, and that should have told me you need to really cut down on your drinking if you feel that you need to take a break for a month. You know, that obviously the drinking is a bit excessive, but it just, those dots were not joined at the time. And then when it came to the, you know, drinking during the pandemic, that was the time that I realized that the bottle of wine wasn't enough. You know, we had a drinks cupboard in our utility room that had loads of spirits and stuff that we only kind of kept for visitors or if people wanted to make a cocktail or whatever. And they were full and nobody ever touched them apart from me during the pandemic. Because once that bottle of wine had finished, I suddenly thought, right, I need something else. And so I would hit the vodka. And then you drink the vodka over a period of a few nights, and then you realize, oh, I've drank the bottle. So what do? You put some water in it so nobody notices. So the minute you start to, you know, try and hide your drinking, that is, you know, a real kind of red flag that, you know, that something needs to change. And so, yeah, that's the first time I've told that to anybody. So I'm hoping, you know, even though I say that I was a normal drinker, hold on a minute.
But that's the thing, and I so appreciate your honesty, because this is why we love doing it. I mean, it's great to hear stories like me and Charlie who have kind of overcome alcoholism and work in recovery and stuff, but the kind of most important thing for us in the community, I think, is catching people before they get to that stage. And these honest conversations, there'll be so many people that will have done that as well, Annie, so many people. And it starts with just one time, and it's that kind of shame that comes from it, and it's your subconscious all the time that you've done that. And then it'll maybe be a wee while before you do it again, and it soon builds up. And you spoke about the pre-contemplation stage. Sometimes it's like 10 years for some people, sometimes it's quicker. And everybody's got their own journey. Nobody ever says that we think, that I know of anyway, that's I'm going to stop drinking and they just do it. There's not many people out there that do it. But I think with us talking like this and sharing honestly, and all the work that you and Charlie do in the background as well in terms of the NHS and education piece and the book you've done, hopefully we can get people to think about it sooner. Because it's like, when I listened to your story there, it was like, I was having a glass of wine at night, and then it was like more nights, and you're like, well, that's fine, it's just a glass of wine. And then I had lunch with my friends in the afternoon, and it got a bit earlier. Well, that's fine, it's just a glass of wine. But it's when you piece them all together, that's when you realise, actually, this shouldn't be classed as normal drinking. But when when everybody thinks about their own drinking, they think about these individual stages, I think, rather than piecing them all together. And that's when the bigger piece of the jigsaw, then you're like, well, actually, I mean, this is something that needs to be looked at. So I really appreciate your honesty there, Annie.
Yeah, thanks.
Can I just jump in there, please? Just talk about the NHS again, Annie. Just talk about your contemplation. And I think a lot of people know they drink too much, or the, you know, whatever that looks like for them, you know, but they know they're drinking more, and they know it isn't serving them well. But because society kind of tells you that, you know, drinking's, you know, a good way to relax, and it's a very sociable thing, and you know, and I think more than ever these days, sort of, you know, the amount of bars and restaurants that keep opening and changing, and you know, people are going out more than they ever did. I think it's kind of almost becoming more normal to a degree, perhaps, I don't know. But just talk about the NHS, Annie. I sometimes wish that, and I know we, you know, everyone's got the right to make their own choices in life, and we can't preach and we can't demand that people live a certain type of life. But I sometimes wish that governments and NHS linked to that were just a little bit more on the front foot about the negative aspects of, the many negative aspects of alcohol, beyond, you know, on society, in terms of what it does to relationships, what it does to sort of people's health, what it does to mental health. But we don't, do we? We kind of sort of say, you know, well, we have this, you know, don't drink more than 14 units of alcohol a week, but guidance. And that's all, it can be guidance. But I wish sometimes that people are a bit more open about, let's be honest, if alcohol is causing you a problem, you're not the only one. Here's the things you can do about it and be a bit more on the front foot. Do you agree with that? And do you, and I know you've, you, we talked about this before, but do you see a changing on it at any point in the future?
The WHO and the NHS know that there are five big chronic diseases that we are constantly trying to deal with worldwide, and they are diabetes, cardiovascular, chronic respiratory diseases, cancer, and stroke. Now, alcohol doesn't really affect the respiratory disease, but the other four, it is a primary causative factor, you know? And actually, you know, by taking away one thing that could help to improve those five big diseases, how many people would we save, and how much revenue would, you know, be saved across the world in healthcare, you know, costs because of us looking at one of the contributing factors. So, you know, there are drug and alcohol services that are working to help those that are in need of help with alcohol, but the people like me that didn't even realize that there wasn't, you know, a need for help, but I was going to continue to develop the consequences of, you know, feeling unwell with alcohol, that continued stress. You know, it's almost like, yes, there's a bigger conversation I think we need to have. And so Charlie and myself are already trying to do something in a very small way within the NHS. So my own trust that I used to work for in East London, we have been involved with the drug and alcohol services there now for probably the last 3 years, going in to help with you know, continuing professional development for the staff at the hospital in terms of looking at alcohol in a different perspective to just, you know, the dependent drinker. We are bringing in the conversation about this middle lane drinking, this spectrum of drinking, the term grey area drinking. I don't know how helpful that is, but for the staff and, you know, the users of the service to suddenly recognise that, you know, we shouldn't just be treating people who have already got and to that rock bottom and have jumped off that cliff. You know, there's a lot more that we could be doing. And so by educating and talking and having these conversations in the background, you know, I think things are starting to happen. Charlie and myself as well are also going to be doing a workshop at a festival in June called what's it called? It's called Every Woman Festival. And the Every Woman Festival is actually led by a series of clinicians that are talking about women's health. So that would be things like menopause, talking about breast health, you know, anything to do with women's health. But they've asked us to come along and talk about alcohol. So, you know, in small ways, alcohol is now coming into the conversations. And I think, especially women that are going through menopause, you know, it's quite big, the conversation now about how alcohol, you know, affects menopause. It's almost like throwing a whole load of, you know, petrol or gasoline on top of a raging fire to, you know, increase symptoms. So people are starting to really look at alcohol in a different way. And I think the NHS and healthcare professionals across the world are beginning to listen. And I think we're in a really exciting time at the moment that maybe it's the post-pandemic, you know, people starting to really think about their well-being in a different way. And it's not just now about what we're putting into our bodies in terms of food and whatever. It's like, you know, everything else. What am I ingesting? What am I actually drinking? And so it's not just a fad. I think people are really starting to look at alcohol through a well-being perspective rather than, you know, something that they have to do because they've got themselves into this kind of, you know, state that they need help for.
And I think, Anna, you'd said there, sorry, and you'd said about just like a small piece, right? And it might just be a small piece, but I think it's so important. Obviously, the Scottish NHS and English NHS are different entities, but I see like it's like intervention stage, which we talk about often, instead of like preventative stage, which is kind of what you guys are doing. And I know I'd volunteered for a charity up in Glasgow, and the counsellors, it was an alcohol charity, counseling people that were kind of having a little bit of problem with alcohol. And even at that stage, for the counsellors that hadn't had any difficulties with alcohol in their own lives, great counsellors, but didn't understand the whole, like, we can talk and say moderation doesn't work, for instance. And this charity and the counsellors were trying to get the people that they were treating and helping to drink less, to moderate, to just have a couple of drinks and then stop. And it's that whole education piece around, like, it's not always and it's usually not possible. So I think what you guys are doing in that space, educating and kind of showing people that there's a way to stop without you getting to that stage. Because I think a lot of people can progress to that stage, even if you've not got the genetic predisposition and trauma in your life and stuff. Yeah. A lot of people can still get to that stage, and that's why I think it's so important. I love what you guys are doing in that space.
I think you're totally right. I mean, it is possible for anybody to get to the stage where alcohol becomes so problematic, you know, that it's life limiting. It's terrible. And everybody has the ability to do that. I know William Porter in his book suggests that, you know, alcohol is addictive. And so, you know, if we are drinking something that is addictive, we will become addicted to it, you know. And that, I think in a way, it's that whole kind of stages of change thing comes in again. That you're more likely to make a change if you have consequences of any sort. So those could be something pretty minor for somebody that, you know, really doesn't have a tolerance for hangovers. You know, that could be your consequence, waking up the next morning and feeling, you know, I feel rubbish, I can't go to work, and, you know, I'm going to miss out on something today. I don't want to feel like this. That could be a consequence for some people. Other consequences, you know, can be much more severe, you know, losing marriages, jobs, you know, money, losing your life. You know, I mean, there's so much that could, you know, if you continue along that path, you are potentially, you know, we're all heading in that direction. And so it's, where do you jump off? You know, where do you decide? And actually, to be honest with you, you know, because alcohol is so accepted and expected in society, we're still going to battle for a long time, I think, in terms of anybody even realizing that there needs to be a change. You know what I mean? So there's still people who are out there that don't have the awareness that we do, the education that we've had, you know, just by going, listening to podcasts, reading books, you know, watching videos. There's so much out there now for people to get that education. But actually, there's still a lot of people who are walking around with blinkers on who really think there's nothing wrong with drinking. And I'm not saying that there is. It's just, you know, if you're not having any consequences, then fine, go ahead, fill your boots, do what you need to. But I think, you know, the current thinking is it's all to do with the amount you drink, when actually it's not about anything to do with the amount you drink. It really isn't. It's how it makes you feel. It's what are the consequences for you personally, you know, and that could just be mental consequences. It could be this constant thinking, you know, not necessarily the hang. You might be somebody that doesn't even have a hangover, but it's the constant thinking about drinking that is something that needs to be, you know, dealt with. And so addiction, you know, it's a huge subject, but actually reliance, as Charlie has put in his book, was something that spoke more to me, because I don't really like labels. I don't really like the alcoholic label. I don't like the non-drinking, the grey area drinking. The labels I don't think are particularly helpful. But I do think it made a lot of sense to me the minute that he wrote about the fact that, you know, there's so many of us that have become reliant on alcohol in a way that is detrimental to us in many ways. We're using alcohol because we think it is helping us, you know, that hungry, angry, lonely, tired that we don't really pay attention to. It's actually it's doing a job. You know, we're using it to fulfill a purpose. It helped me to not be lonely when, you know, my husband was still going out drinking. I now know that it actually also helped me to belong. You know, this deep feeling that I'd had from being a child, you know, being accepted and loved by my family, that was great. But at the same time, you know, the subconscious childhood feelings that I grew up with was that I didn't fit in, that I didn't look like my family, that I didn't, they made me feel like I belong, but I didn't feel
inherently like I did. And what alcohol did for me was I gave it a great job. You know, let me be social. Let me fit in with other people. Let me be part of this. But for many years, I didn't know that. I didn't have a clue that that was the job I was giving alcohol to. So it's raising that awareness, isn't it? And I think, again, going back to the whole NHS thing, it's just so much we can do in that awareness stage of, yeah, you know, talking about, you know, the being a bit more open, I suppose, in terms of the units. There's something that is, it's hidden there on an NHS app. People can go and look at it, but it still doesn't really make sense. But at the end of the day, it's more really tapping into people's patterns and why they've developed these patterns, and you know, how they can move beyond that and develop new patterns. And that's what I do with my coaching. That's a lot of the work that I do is helping people to reframe and to change those patterns that have been developed over many decades.
Yeah. Can I just chip in there? I want to talk about your coaching and mm-hmm. and the other sort of great work that you do in the alcohol-free space, if you know what I mean. But before we do that, just when you were talking there about, you know, about the NHS and about sort of consequences, it was absolutely bang on. It was all about consequences to ourselves, wasn't it? But there's also the consequences of what we do to others when we drink too much. And it can be on a really subtle level, can't it? It can affect our relationships, because in my case, I can be cranky and I can be anxious and I can be irritable and I can just not be very good company. Or when I was drinking, by the way, I'm perfect now. That was a joke. But there's also, there's the consequences, bigger consequences as well, isn't there? And, you know, you hear all the time of, you know, for example, and tell me if I'm talking above my pay grade, but you talk about, you know, sort of A&E being absolutely full of people who are there, you know, largely due to, you know, something to do with drinking. And yet these things are kind of almost laughed off. It's like, oh, it's all right. I was drunk. Yeah, I was drunk. Is it okay? Is it all right? Should it be laughed off? Because this is having a huge cost and impact on the NHS. It's having a huge cost and impact on society. And I'm not being I'm not getting on my sort of soapbox and saying that the world needs to do this, that, and the other. But it's not okay, is it? And it should be sort of made to be clear that it isn't okay. And having had a drink or a lot of drink isn't necessarily just, that doesn't make it all right.
No.
Yeah, I don't expect you to answer that, Anya, by the way, but, you know, just please, at least please agree with me. Yeah.
No, do you know, I do agree with you, but and I'm not at all finger pointing at anybody that I worked with or whatever, but I know for a fact the hospitals that I used to work at, they were full of hospital staff at you know, going home time. So I think if the staff you know, who are seeing these patients, it's hard, isn't it? I think it's something that is going to take some time to change. I mean, yes, you know, working in the NHS is the same as working in a very high pressured environment in so many other areas, like teaching, like, you know, I'm sure every type of job can say that it was stressful. And so people need a release. So it's about teaching people there are different ways of being able to release stress and tension and deal with it in a more healthy way. But at the same time, you know, that's a bigger piece, because, you know, the reason people are stressed and whatever, because we're understaffed, we're not paid enough, you know, you can go on and on and on. So, you know, where does this stop? You know, does there need to be more money put into organizations for health and well-being and self-care and whatever? Yeah.
I think as well, you kind of highlighted something about it's not how much you drink. So, and we know that as just simple people having a conversation, that it's not about how much you drink that has the effect on you. But that's the messaging from the NHS and the government. Like, yeah, you can just have this amount of drinks and just, do you know what I mean? That's what the messaging is all around. Instead of, like, are you feeling anxious? Are you feeling depressed? Are you drinking to cope? There's none of that messaging out there. And if people are not searching for alcohol-free podcasts and am I an alcoholic, they're not finding out that information. And I think we are so lucky in this community that we've got, that we'll learn from each other. Like, we'll come off this Zoom, for instance, and we'll have learned something. And that's the joy of the alcohol-free space that we're in. but not everyone's got access to that. And I think although there is all these podcasts and everything out there, the messaging from the marketing companies and from the government and NHS it's not in line with what we're talking about here. So and there's much more messaging out there from the NHS, the government and advertising companies than there is here, is what I'm trying to say. I don't know if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does. And I think that this is where we probably, I keep saying we, because I'm no longer in the NHS, but, you know, we need to move beyond consumption and really think about consequences and control, because asking those questions, you know, is definitely going to be able to help more people than asking somebody, how much are you drinking? You know, that means nothing. You know, I don't know how tall you are.
Exactly what I was trying to say there, Annie.
Yeah. And you did it in 2 seconds.
I went round the houses.
No.
That was exactly what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's asking people, you know, can you stop? You know, do you have any consequences as a result of drinking? As Ian said, you know, with your relationships, with your boss, with your colleagues, you know, with your children, you know, it's having a deeper conversation with people about really getting in the underlying factors as to why people are drinking, not how much they're drinking. We need to move away from that.
Yeah, that's it. Bang on, in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So Annie, Kelly, please do.
Right. Yes. Annie, you said about the labels as well, and unfortunately labels just get used all the time. People seem to kind of work better with labels, I think. And I used to be like the grey area drinking thing. I would be like, oh, just a problematic drinker that doesn't want to admit that they've got a problem kind of thing. That's how I looked at it, and I don't look at it like that now. I think it's such a great term, and the reason I think it's a great term is because it doesn't have stigma or shame attached to it. So people are more inclined to use it, and I think review their alcohol consumption, like you've spoke about. Yeah, it was problematic at times. It wasn't problematic all the time. And I think that's how the grey area drinking, I love that you've used that in the past, and I know the grey area drinker, Olivia, has used that as well. And I think it is, labels are sometimes annoying and unhelpful, but I think in some cases they can be, because it gives people that, yeah, it takes that shame and stigma away a little bit.
I think you're right. I think definitely for me, I could identify with this term as soon as I heard it, because suddenly I realised, you know, that this old-fashioned, you know, normal drinker and problematic drinker, it wasn't just the black and white thinking anymore. It was almost, this was the first time I realised there's a spectrum. There is a spectrum. And being able to identify myself with another group of people made me feel, I suppose, like I belonged. Do you know what I mean? I go back to that term again. It's really important to me to belong to something. And it's almost like, okay, I've found other people that are like me, that I can talk to about the way that, you know, that I'm having my consequences with alcohol, that I didn't, you know, like the way it was making me feel, that, you know, it was just really helpful for me as a term to begin with. It's interesting that I think, I didn't answer your question earlier, Ian, that ages ago, that you thought I was 6 years alcohol-free. So I started my alcohol-free journey 6 years ago, but I'm 4.5 years alcohol-free now. When I got going with it. And it's interesting now, 4.5 years later or 6 years later, that I really think it's helpful to have that term so that it can encourage more people to start talking about their alcohol use and how it's affecting them. And, you know, are there any consequences that, you know, they wish that weren't there that they want to discuss further? But also, you know, for me now, I kind of feel that, you know, if you're holding a glass, you're drinking, and it doesn't really matter how, you know, how much you drink, when you drink, whatever. The fact is, if you're drinking, you're a drinker, you know, and so we all need to be part of this conversation because it matters to all of us, you know. It doesn't matter. I've coached ladies that drink only on a Friday night of the week, and they don't want to do it anymore. Yeah. They actually want to stop the Friday night drinking. That, to me, in my old days, was not problematic, but that woman is. And you know what? How many people across the globe are we missing that really want to make those kind of same decisions? You know, they just, it's not working for them anymore, so they want to stop, but they don't know how to do it. And so, yeah, I think the labels are helpful, maybe to identify where you are in your alcohol journey, or, you know, your relationship with alcohol. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, your podcast last week, Kelly, my husband's journey, for me, I've just really enjoyed listening to everybody's stories and realizing that, you know, wherever alcohol is in our story, there's always been some negativity. Yeah. There was always some fun. There was always some fun in the earlier days, and then it became not so much fun. And actually, it doesn't make a difference how much we were drinking. We've all kind of led that same kind of arc, if you like. Yeah. And hopefully now, coming back full circle to the person that we really want to be now, now that we're no longer, you know, needing it.
Yeah, which is a nice way into what I thought we should chat about next, Annie, which is, so we spoke about your story, mm-hmm. your story, your drinking story that got you to where you are now, 4.5 years alcohol-free. Spoke about, you know, the NHS and sort of, you know, the sort of the consequences, if you like, on the NHS, etc. But then you've mentioned a couple of times there about some of the other work that you're doing, sort of, you know, in the alcohol-free space and in coaching and sort of, you know, sort of getting the message out there, if you like. Just tell us a bit more about that, please, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so I absolutely love my coaching. I love it because it is just seeing people change and the ability for people to change. You know, being able to drop the alcohol identity and really step into this alcohol-free identity. It's just the most amazing, wonderful thing. I'm really grateful for every single day that I have been in my coaching life. And I feel that, you know, in my own experiences of trying to do a dry January and white knuckling it through a month, what you're doing there is you're using willpower. You are gritting your teeth. You're using your fingers clenched all the way through the month. You're literally just avoiding alcohol, and you are not really, you know, learning anything about your relationship with alcohol. You are just clawing your way through the month. And then what do we mostly do? We drink our month's worth at the end of the month. And that's what I did. But actually, coaching helps to really delve into the deeper layers underneath the reasons why people are drinking. So it's more of an educational piece. Not that I am there to educate people. I help them to educate themselves by raising awareness of, you know, the underlying factors that have maybe caused them to drink. You know, and what we do is I use things like neuro-linguistic programming, which is a practice that just really helps people to change their thinking and the language that they're using to create different actions. And so I run one-to-one coaching and small group coaching, and I find the small group coaching in particular is really helpful because it's putting all those elements in, again, of the community, you know, the sharing, being able to talk openly about your relationship with alcohol, but also an opportunity for people to start moving forwards, because coaching is not like therapy. Therapy looks at your past and what's happened in your life. Coaching takes you from where you are now to where you want to be much quicker than if you were going to try and do it by yourself. And so having a supporter, somebody that is able to facilitate your thinking by asking the right questions, suddenly it raises awareness that you weren't aware of before. What I actually help people to do is tap into their subconscious and all of their strengths and skills that they already have within them. And this helps to rebuild the identity that's been lost because of alcohol, probably one that we probably stopped it in our teens because if most of us started drinking then. Our true identity was then, and it's almost going back to that time. I'm not telling people that they've got to go back to the teenage years and do all those things, but it's rediscovering who you really are underneath the alcohol. And it's a wonderful process, you know, of just watching somebody join those dots up themselves, but also to have the realization of what role alcohol was playing in their lives. And how they can do it in a much healthier way, in different ways. And that's what I do with my coaching, is just help people to rediscover their life without alcohol, but actually also to understand some of the reasons why they were drinking in the first place. And I use many tools. You know, there's one of the, we talk a lot about boundaries. values work is so important in terms of, you know, looking at our new identity that's not drinking, but also cognitive reframing in so many ways, really getting people to sort of watch their language, think about how they're talking to themselves, the thoughts that they're using. And then we reframe all of that by conversation. You know, we talk about how they might want to talk in a more positive way that is going to help them to create this new non-drinking identity. I'm kind of going a little bit off topic here, sorry. What I wanted to bring in was I think a lot of people who are drinking for stress reasons in particular are caught in the Cartman drama triangle. And I know I was for many years.
What's that called, sorry?
Cartman drama triangle. And it's recognizing which role you've been playing within it. So you are either a rescuer, a victim, or a persecutor. And actually, you know, if you think about any of your arguments and stresses that you've got with somebody, you know, to have a moment to think, which of those roles am I playing in this relationship? And I know for me, it was always the rescuer. I was jumping in to help people all the time. Maybe that was the reason why I worked so well in the NHS, a caring profession that is always there to look after everybody else. But actually, what you realize is that, you know, you end up sort of drinking to relieve the stress of not being able to put your own oxygen mask on because you've given all of your energy and your time to everybody else, you know. But I think it's just an interesting question for people to ask, you know, if you had to give yourself one of those roles, could you identify with being a persecutor, a victim, or a rescuer? And coaching helps to take you out of the drama triangle and actually see that relationship from a different perspective. So it no longer is something that you have to drink at anymore. So a lot of people that I work with have issues with colleagues at work, relationships at home, their children, you know, friends. It's almost like the Cartman drama triangle is something that I help people to work through just by identifying which of those roles they think that they might be playing. And, yeah, and until you raise that awareness, nobody knows, you know?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, we're over time. We need to get you back on, Annie, so we can, because there's probably loads there that we haven't talked about, which we could actually sort of, you know, do another podcast on. So if you don't mind, we'll.
Do you know what? Sorry.
Yeah. No, go on. Please do. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, I think one of the things that I wanted to say as well is that I think the whole identity thing is huge in alcohol change in terms of, you know, us moving through any kind of old drinking self to a non-drinking self. And a lot of these kind of, you know, programs that might say just do 30 days and just take a break, a lot of them are just working at a behavior level. And actually what we do really, I think, in our sobriety communities like you do, these ongoing kind of communities that are constantly keeping these conversations going, is that you're moving through not just from behavioral, you're moving into beliefs and values, you're moving into really changing people's perception about alcohol and what it's doing for them and to them, to be able to change their identity. And it is a process, and it's something that really takes time. And I think I really want people to know that there is no quick on and off switch with sobriety. It is a process, and it's a beautiful process. You might not see it just yet, but oh my God, just keep on going. And seriously, it just keeps on giving. It's like I am still, you know, having these wonderful moments of, you know, things happening to me, and I'm just like, wow, this is because of my sobriety. The conversations that I have and the people that I meet and the things that I'm doing. It's just, it's about identity, and it's about how do we change our identity to that non-drinking sober self, the one that's going to get everything in life that they want.
I've been thinking about this today because I don't know what made me that thought, like six years down the line, keep saying that, 6 years, if anyone's in any doubt, I am 6 years alcohol free. And
not yet.
No, it could all go wrong. It does keep changing all the time, doesn't it, Annie? It does sort of, like, and it sounds a bit cheesy, and we hear these words quite a lot. The buzzwords for a reason, because they apply. But you do find out a lot about yourself, and you're constantly learning about yourself all the time. And I'm still finding out things about me now, 6 years down the line, that things that apply to me. And I just I can't think of any off the bad examples, but just all the time, just learning new stuff and becoming more comfortable with who I am and not fighting with myself all the time. Like you say before about, for me, I was probably I was a victim, I reckon, from just what you're describing there. It was always, woe is me, the world's against me because of X, Y, and Z. It wasn't against me. I was just fighting with it all the time, and I've stopped fighting, and it's like, it's lovely,
Do you know when you say that, Ian? Like, I just can't imagine. It just shows you what alcohol does to us as people. Because when you say that, I can't imagine you being that person. I can't imagine you being that always me. So it just
Definitely.
shows
Just,
you how alcohol can change then, doesn't it?
all that's always all the negatives in everything. just wasn't grateful or appreciative of, what I had. Don't get me wrong, that's not true, but I was always an outgoingly happy person, but inside I was battling all the time, battling to try and get heard, battling to be appreciated, battling to be recognized, sort of whatever. And just, yeah, these days, just go with it.
Do you know, I know we've gone massively over the time, we keep saying we're going to stop, but I just wanted to say as well that I totally resonate with that, that we are changing all of the time. And I think, it's taken me to about 4 years to realize that this innate need to fit in, belong, be part of a gang, group, whatever, always want to fit in with other people. It's almost like I've come to this realization that actually just being me is okay. I am okay as I am. I don't need to fit in, belong, and be accepted by other people. It's almost like I've accepted myself. And that is what happens in sobriety. It's
Absolutely.
creating that new self-assurance and that self-worth. And it's
And
just
that's what's amazing about sobriety and alcohol-free life. It's not the holidays and adventures and the marathons and all this that we talk about, and that's all great, but it's just exactly what you said there, Annie. It's just finding that peace and contentment and accepting yourself. I absolutely love that. Love that.
Kelly, we were doing so well until 1 hour and however many minutes you've mentioned marathons. We weren't talking anything about fitness and nothing tonight. We got through the whole thing
We
without
did.
about any exercise
We did.
whatsoever. Annie, if people want to get hold of you, and sort of, visit your website or visit you on socials or just find out a bit more about you, how do they go about that?
So I am on Instagram as at AF, which stands for alcohol free, but it's AF underscore Rainbow Rider is my Instagram. And then you can also find me on my website, which is annieknowlescoaching.com. And I hope that you will put some other links. I'm on LinkedIn. Look for my name, Annie Knowles. I'm on LinkedIn, and I've got a Facebook coaching group as well. Look for Annie Knowles Coaching.
We'll be
Amazing.
sharing it on as well. You'll be sharing on the socials, won't you, Kelly? I haven't got a clue,
I
but
will. I've got it shared on socials. It has been so lovely chatting to you, Annie. It really has. It's given me a boost tonight. I was like a bit tired tonight and thinking, oh, I can't be bothered chatting to these two.
Oh,
It's really, I
how
know, it
harsh.
really energized me.
Try
It's just
chatting to
really,
old friends. It's
I
been
know,
great. It has.
it's really energized me. It's been really, really lovely.
Thank
Thank
Kelly, finally. Sorry, Annie. Kelly, finally, if anyone wants to get hold of us, find out a bit more about Alcohol Uncensored, how can they do that?
you. You can get us on Instagram at alcohol underscore uncensored, or the website alcoholuncensored.co.uk, or drop us an email at team at alcoholuncensored.co.uk.
And if anybody wants to jump on a Zoom or a chat with Kelly and I and learn a bit about more about the community on a try before you
Absolutely.
buy type basis, love to do that. So just, get in touch and we can do that. Annie, we need to get you back on because I feel like we had to cut you short there in your prime and there was loads we could have talked about. So we'll get something organised in the future if
We
that's okay
continued.
with you. Yeah,
I would love to come back. Yeah, it feels like I'm coming back to see my old mates.
Oh, it's lovely, lovely. Thank you very much. Right, guys, have a good time, whatever you're doing, and take care. See you later.